we need a place to bring our children and ignore them while we hang out with other adults and the kids run around and have fun.
Hillary Clinton, you do say her point of it takes a village. It's actually true. What do you mean by that?
Parenthood is so stressful. It doesn't look appealing. It doesn't seem appealing. It's a little sad that, you know, that six kids makes you an exhibit.
You don't have to take on all these burdens yourself.
So some of the decisions you think you have to make, you can make the opposite decision.
Welcome to the Loopcast. We have a special guest, my good friend Tim Carney. He is a senior columnist for the Washington Examiner and a senior fellow at AEI. Mr. Carney's forthcoming book, Family Unfriendly, How Our Culture Made Raising Kids Much Harder Than It Needs to Be, will launch on March 19th, 2024. He's a Catholic dad of six, and by the grace of God, survived being my roommate many, many moons ago. Tim, glad to have you on the show.
Good to see you, Josh. You haven't aged a day since 2001. You really looked that bad back then, so yeah.
I was going to say, I don't think I was bald, though, back then, but...
Neither was I.
That's true. I didn't expect you to lose it. Everyone knew I was going to be losing the hair, but... Well, I have to say, despite the fact I accidentally butchered the title of your book in a recent Loopcast, but I made amends and got it back in there. I have to say, I thoroughly enjoyed your book, and I'm looking forward to diving into it here with you. I was really caught by a moment that you mentioned early on in the book about being at the fish fry at St. Andrew Apostle, and you mentioned it's a very culturally diverse parish. But one thing that they kind of had in common was it's largely a middle class or upper middle class parish. And Father Bill was asking about what he called the unmet needs of the parish. And you had a kind of provocative answer. Walk us through that.
Yeah. So the conversation started with me wondering why, you know, parishes were shrinking in their relevance in even to faithful Catholics. And he said, he described the services they performed when he was a kid and he was about my age. And he said, you know, it used to be the main source of youth sports. We're in Montgomery County, Maryland, wealthy place. Youth sports was all taken over by elite leagues, yada, yada. And he said, you know, 20 years before that, it was the place where a hungry family got fed. And now, you know, government agencies have cropped up to take care of this. And I said, well, we don't want to compete with them, do we? He said, no, we want to fill the unmet needs of the people in this room. And he kind of asked me, what are they? And I paused for a second. I said, we need a place to bring our children and ignore them while we hang out with other adults and the kids run around and have fun. And so he said,
ignore them. How could you possibly ignore them?
Exactly.
It's a cardinal sin.
Take for 1 second, take your foot off the gas of the enrichment of the, you know, D1 scholarship of the Harvard or maybe they'll fall off the jungle gym and break their arm. Or maybe if you turn around for 12 seconds, a well-trained abductor will grab them, throw them in the back of the waiting getaway car and speed off. All of those fears that are behind the sort of middle class and upper middle class parents, we realized that that was sort of a ministry was to alleviate those fears of the parents and to make parenting seem less stressful. Something had happened in a generation that made parenting seem so hard to the point that people think they need to be millionaires to do it, or they can only have one or two kids because they need to give them the best of everything. And I wrote Family Unfriendly in part to take the lesson from that parish hall, that fish fry, out to anyone who wants to read the book.
Yeah, you don't have to be Liam Neeson with a special set of skills to be an actual parent.
Yeah.
I mean, So what did you end up doing there? I guess you had some sort, you organized some sort of, you know, contraband event, right?
So I called Father Dan, who was a pastor. I said, I want to set up a T-ball program. Now, I didn't hatch it all on my own. It was at the end of a CYO basketball season. We all meet for pizza at our local church was called the Stained Glass Pub. So it even had a little Catholic element to it there. And at the Stained Glass Pub, the CYO director was like, you should just
CYO is Catholic Youth Organization, for those who may not realize what you're saying.
Oh, yeah. So CYO, the Catholic Youth Organization, sort of the traditional basketball program for elementary school, middle schoolers. And he said, you should just do T-ball on the back campus like St. Bernadette's is. Now, that's the actual preface of Family and Friendly starts in St. Bernadette's, where we had brought our kids to what we thought was just plain old T-ball. And it was all the kids run wild. And the parents drink what I call semi-legal alcohol. The pastor's not allowed to say, go get a drink, but it is private property. And so if you show up, anyway, so we set up our own mini version at St. Andrew's, and we set up a grill. And this was the great thing, is somebody's like, well, what should we charge? Da-da-da. And my wife said, how about we just put out a basket and just people throw in what they want to throw in? And that was a brilliant touch. My goal, and they still do it every spring at St. Andrews, even though we've gone to Virginia, is the T-ball is almost an excuse. I would coach the T-ball, and the other people I would call the grill coaches, because they were just as essential. They were just flip burgers, or we'd order cheese pizza.
That'd be my natural talent.
Yeah, we ordered cheese pizza when it was during Lent, and we would just serve them, and what you pay whatever you can. But the main goal, the main thing, had nothing to do with the T-ball players. It was more the parents. Could they let their five-year-old, who's just younger than T-ball age, could they let their five-year-old wander around St. Andrew's campus unattended? Could they let their five-year-old play on the jungle gym with a bunch of other kids and turn away? Let little Chloe climb there while you turn. Somebody hands you a Miller Lite and you have a conversation. That was my real goal, was alleviating the need, the perceived need, to helicopter, to create a place where parents could bring their kids and ignore them.
Why is it so important to have this kind of what you call low pressure family time?
It's important for the kids and it's important for the parents. Kids, I don't know if you saw, Josh, there was an op-ed a few weeks ago in the American Journal of Pediatrics by these leading pediatricians. And they said the reason childhood anxiety is on the rise is because kids don't have enough independent play that is unsupervised by adults. So that is, mom and dad aren't there, a coach, a gym teacher isn't telling them what to do. They're just doing what most of us in Gen X did. Leave, hey, dinner's at 6, don't be late. Or dinner's at 6, if you're late, you don't eat. And so that is good for kids. But also, when I look at the collapsing birth rates, and that's really one of the things that inspired me to write Family Unfriendly, was it started off as like a demographics book. Why is a birth rate collapsed to 1.7? By the time I finished the book, it was down to 1.6. And I think part of it is that parenthood is so stressful, it doesn't look appealing. It doesn't seem appealing to the millennials who are now going into child-rearing rage, because they had the helicoptering, they had the high ambition, the high stress, maximum effort parenting. And the idea that parenting is something you can do as part of a rich, fun, and fulfilled life, that was present in a few subcultures. I write a little about my own Catholic subculture in D.C. I write about the Latter-day Saints in Utah and Idaho. I write about Jews in Israel and in Kemp Mill, Maryland. In these sort of subcultures, kids are free range and parents are happier and parents have more kids.
Yeah, and it's even funny that like you talk about having that playtime. Like, I was just sort of mystified. Like, when I grew up, we got Legos. In fact, you know, my mom was pretty cheap, so we got generic Legos. They weren't even the real ones, but... And then now kids today, they get these Legos and it's like all you do is assemble the actual magic, you know, like Millennium Falcon or whatever. It's like, to me, I was like, well, this is kind of boring. I feel like this is a job just to put together these pieces. It's like, to me, I would create my own villages, you know, have cars zoom around. I just felt like we're kind of missing something, even in the way that we play. It's just kind of a mystery.
Open-ended play. I mean, the Lego movie was actually a really good movie, because that was the point of it, was that the overbearing dad like almost wanted to crazy glue everything together, and that the real joy was take it apart and build it up and do whatever you want. And on the Legos, another note for me is watching my 11-year-old still plays with the Legos as a way of making play world for her 7-year-old younger sister. And so that mixed age play, that's another thing that's totally lost when everything is supervised, right? If you're just playing on your team or your Boy Scouts or whatever, that you're going to be in a crew that's just your own age. Once it's kids running the neighborhood or having 6, 8, 9 kids, you're more likely to get that great mixed age play, which is sort of stimulating for the older kids as well as enriching for the younger kids, and allows mom and dad to sit on the balcony and have a cup of coffee.
What's really fascinating, though, about, you know, like the low birth rate, I mean, the thing that kind of strikes me is that, you know, I'm not trying to attack my father or my grandpa by saying this, but I know I do a ton more chores around the house than they did. And in fact, I'm not the exception. A lot of dads my age are doing a lot more chores around the house. It's just sort of a natural thing. And yet we're also seeing moms work more outside of the home than they used to. So you would think, huh, that probably means that moms aren't able to spend nearly as much time with their children just because there's only so many hours in a week. But in fact, you note moms are nevertheless actually spending more time with the kids. It's becoming this helicopter thing.
Yeah, 50% more time. It's insane compared to 1975. And so, it is good that dads chip in more. It's great that women have equal economic opportunity, but the fact, and families are smaller. So why? More help from dad, more obligations outside the home, fewer kids. Why is the time going up? And so the whole project I tried to do with this book is sort of look at the social science data, combine it with my own experience as a kid and now as a dad and with, you know, a bunch of other dad and mom friends in our circles, and as well as the reporting. I have a great job. I get to go around the country, you know, again, Utah to the places in New England where nobody's having babies, and try to tell the story because it's a really complicated one. But I think that the data point you just pointed out is one of the ones that just catches everybody's attention. Why are moms spending 50% more time every week on raising their kids than they used to? And this is correlated with the baby bus, I believe. I quote sociologists. Isabel Sawhill is pretty good on like 90% of stuff, but then she says she embraces that the U.S. is having fewer kids. She says in a wealthier, more educated society, parents are choosing quality over quantity. I'm thinking, Josh, I guess you and I went for the quantity angle. I think my kids are top shelf, but maybe I'm wrong. But the quality isn't quality. The intensive parenting, again, it's leading to that anxiety, that parental burnout, and in turn, I think, leading to people having fewer kids than they would ideally have because it sounds like just such a burden to them.
Well, and you know, this is the thing. You mentioned in the book, your friend Kevin DeYoung, he kind of highlighted a bit of a paradox in that he said, with fewer children, parents actually become more child-centric in their lives. And as parents become more child-centric, they do not see how they could possibly have more than one or two children. And so my wife and I are always, you know, you mentioned this book, same for us with having six kids. We just remark every time I go to the pediatric dentist, she is just wowed. Like, yeah, you have six kids. How does that work? It's like, to her, it's her chance. Like, this is like an exhibit at the zoo. You know, who are these strange creatures? And then you mentioned the carnies going to the zoo. This is too good. We have to share this with the audience. I love this.
So the zoo is something I always love doing. And in Washington, D.C., the zoo is we say free. It's paid for by you, the taxpayer. Thank you very much. Come and visit.
I appreciate
that. You don't have to pay
at
the gate. And so I would bring the kids. And, you know, as a parent, everything you're doing, you're figuring it as you go. It's a learning on the job. It's low-skilled work is what I say about parenting. You pick up the skills as you go on. And after a couple of times, I developed a system for going to the zoo. And the National Zoo, it's on a hill. And so some people always park at the bottom so that then they slowly go up and then make their way back down. But the parking lots at the bottom cost money. I'm a cheapskate dad, so I would park on a Saturday in the spots that I knew were free on Connecticut Avenue and see the exhibits walking down. You could imagine how exhausted the kids are after this. So my system was get a double stroller, strap the baby to my chest. There was a little skateboard thing on the back of the double stroller. So that's 1, 2, 3, 4 kids. And then the two older kids are on either side of me. and we just run up the hill. We turn into like a forced march, like in basic training in the military. And as I'm doing this and I'm like calling out to the kids, I realized at one point there was these parents gawking at me, but then it got better. At one point, I see some kid grab his dad and pull his dad's attention away from the rhinoceros and point at us. And I just thought, wow, the Carney family went to the zoo and became an exhibit. And it's a little sad that, you know, that six kids makes you an exhibit.
You didn't charge them admission either.
It was totally
$6,
free.
$6, buddy.
But the how do you do it question is premised on the assumption that we all do the max effort stuff. But I want to go back to the Kevin DeYoung quote about child-centered. Here I am writing a book about being a dad. I think my Twitter bio calls me a suburban dad. You're like me. Like when girls didn't like us when we were younger, it was because we reminded them of their dad. Like we have been dads since we were since we were like 16. But so why shouldn't we be child-centric, right? And I think Catholic teaching really matters here. We're family-centric. We want the children not to think that they are the center of attention, but that they are crucial role players in an absolutely essential, important unit, which is the family. And to be family-centered is what we aim for. So that's not parent-centered, it's parent-directed. It's not child-centered, it's family-centered. And that's a distinction that I think Catholic teaching has sort of always appreciated, and it gets muddled in a lot of the modern talk about it.
Yeah, see, we're Gen Xers. I think like the older boomers that raised us, I'm not trying to call out our parents per se, but I'm saying that culture was very, you know, focused on the parents and not really the kids. Like, we joke about this, like Gen X, like total free range. Like, I mean, I could watch whatever movies I wanted to. I could go wherever I wanted to. No one really ever cared. Like, and it was, there's a lot of freedom in that. And I just think, you know, the snapback to that was to a sort of low trust, high anxiety, maximum effort parenting that's, I would call it that the target moms embrace. And it creates this level of stress and social pressure. I'm sure Instagram is only making that worse. And it makes it so intense. Like, if you think about it, like, well, why would I want to get married and have that, you know, for me? Like, that sounds miserable.
You mentioned Instagram. I make an analogy. I liken it to sort of kudzu or some invasive species. That what parents naturally want to do, or would-be parents naturally want to do, is build a family culture. And if you get to shape a family culture, it's like gardening, but with humans. And not that you're raising your kids to be the exact specimen you want to be, but
there is an ecosystem.
Yeah. And that the whole garden is this place that you've helped cultivate. If you don't get to do that, if you don't have say over what shape it takes, not that you can control it, because the controlling is one of the things I push back, but you sort of cultivation of a culture, if you don't have a say over it, it's off-putting. And that's what a lot of young people said to me is, well, I don't think I'd be able to imbue my own values in my kids. I don't think I'd be able to educate my kids. Some people are afraid, well, I got disciplined by my dad and that was good for me, but nowadays if I spank my kid, you know, CPS shows up. All of that, for me, what really drove it home was how social media is this invasive species. Whatever you do in that garden to try to cultivate an environment where your kid growing freely is going to be part of this ecosystem, this invasive species is going to come in and totally change it. And so that, I think, is another thing that makes it off-putting to parents. It's another way that our culture is family unfriendly, is that we're expected to hand kids these devices when they're young. And a lot of people do it without thinking. And then they give them social media without thinking. And they think it's fine. That's just how they communicate with their friends. And then next thing you know, it becomes the new identity for the kid, rather than being a player in a family.
Yeah, I think part of it is that moms and dads can't compete with the social media in many ways. Like, you know, it's all the information, all the things that you might be interested, hyper sorted out exactly for your interest and magnified and intensified. Oh, you like, you know, Star Trek, you like Bubble Guppies, you like whatever, and it's curated for you, and it caters to your needs. How can, as one, you know, mom or dad compete with that? But that's you talk about in your book about the importance of having just like, you know, being in a neighborhood where you have like-minded people and just the value of that. I mean, obviously having a parish community, as you say, on Friday nights where they could play t-ball is good, but just having like-minded people living in the same area can have a pretty demonstrative improvement because people just can hang out at other people's houses. It's something that we used to do in the 80s all the time.
Yep. And again, it being not everything having to be hyper-planned really is a luxury that very few people have. My wife and I, again, we moved from Maryland to Virginia. We're not in the optimal neighborhood where we would be. And so what we rely on to build this ecosystem for our kids' peers and the other adults are reinforcing the values is that we are connected and we have three cars and, you know, even my 17-year-old has a job that can help pay for the bills of that. And my wife is able to stay at home. So we have to sort of pay for that subculture. In the 1960s, it was easier in a lot of places, a suburb of Pittsburgh, that subculture was because you owned a tiny, detached, 1,500-square-foot house in Uniontown, PA. And the subculture was you're going to run around, your kids are going to run around, and if they're doing something stupid, somebody else's mom is going to yell at them. And that's a rarer thing.
Part of that was that you'd accept the fact that you might have a smaller house than you need because you understood the value of the neighborhood for your kids to have friends to play with. And you all essentially kind of co-parent. Like, you're still the primary parent, obviously, but you have this ability to know, I trust the people in my neighborhood, so it's a little bit easier to raise the kids. You mentioned in your book, the problem we have is we've created this horrible, I call it, it's not architecture, the word, but like the way we plan cities and streets, where it's supercar focused. Like, I'm not anti-car, okay? But when I grew up, I could jump on a bike and in 10 minutes, I could be down to the drugstore buying candy bars because I love candy. But also, I could buy baseball cards. And, you know, yeah, you could run into people and say, hi, what's up? You know, but like now, like I remember the thing that struck me about the Columbine shooting in 1999, you have these McMansions and these kids are in these, it's like a desert. It's like a cul-de-sac. And there's, you know, the houses are further and further spread out and you have all you could ever need inside your house in terms of, you know, it's like a mansion and you've got all the food stocked in the pantry and video games. Why would you ever leave the house?
And then you imagine the parents then loading you up with extra tutoring, constantly cracking the whip on homework, putting you in organized events. I mean, I love organized sports. Baseball is one of my favorite things. I loved playing high school baseball. I got to be the center fielder my senior year on varsity. You know what I love more? I love the pickup football games with my friends, the tackle football games when we were like 12 through 16. When we got 17, we started hurting each other in tackle. But up until then, it really is some of my favorite memories. Or pickup basketball where you're covering your best friend and you're like, if he scores the winning basket, I'll chew off my arm and use that to block the shot if that's what it takes to stop my best friend from scoring this win. That was the best thing, the unstructuredness of it. And again, what I try to do in Family and Friendly is tie my own experience as a Gen X kid and someone who's blessed with a family-friendly subculture, combine those experiences and my interviews with the social science, and the social science confirms what you and I suspect, is that largely being left alone is a lot healthier for the kid than the constant management.
See, one of the things I do like about your book, you are so willing to put out these bold statements that attack, I would call, sacred cows of modern parenting in the suburbs. And one of the things you talk about is the travel team trap. And I want to get to this in a second. Actually, my kid, just even this morning, she came to me and to my wife, and she was crying. And she's crying because she's been trying for weeks and weeks and months to line up a play date with her friend. Her friend is maybe against her will, is on all these travel teams for like volleyball and soccer or something like that. And so just trying to arrange a date, and they finally had it locked up. And then at the last minute, it fell apart and she was just in tears. she wants to be with her, you know, her best friend, and it's hard to get to. And I just think to myself, what have we done to our kids that the two kids are just, they're super friends. They'd love to be with each other. And actually, the other kid doesn't even want to play this much sports, honestly. It's the parent.
Yeah, so the travel team trap has lots of causes. And one of the reasons I call it a trap is because a lot of parents who end up in it didn't intend to, maybe even tried to avoid it, but got sucked in. So one of the goals with this book is to sort of say, some of the decisions you think you have to make, you can make the opposite decision. We mentioned smartphones and social media earlier. A lot of parents just don't even think, oh yeah, my iPhone 10 is now outdated. Let's give that to Susie.
This is the thing we got to do. Everyone else is doing it.
Everyone else is doing it. And you don't have to. And the same is with intense elite youth sports. You don't have to. Now, part of the problem is that it becomes harder to do regular sports. When I played Pelham Little League in Pelham, New York, there were future like D1 recruits that were playing with and against me. They played Little League. They also, you know, would play school baseball. And as they got higher, they would play on some elite summer program. I would play on like a second tier summer all-stars program. And the kids who weren't as good, they would play stickball in the summer. But Little League, it was everything from a kid who couldn't swing a bat to a kid who was going to, you know, hit home runs in for Rutgers University. And so nowadays, though, if everybody else is pulling their kids and putting them in elite baseball, you show up at the Little League practice and nobody can throw a strike. I love baseball, Josh, but a walk-a-thon with a bunch of 11-year-olds who can't get the ball over the plate, like the 5-run rule gets hit because there were 9 walks. That's like that's purgatory right there. But that's what happens if all the good. So then the parent thinks, okay, if I just want decent baseball, I got to go into travel. Or worse, the 8th grade coach says, if you want to play on the school team, you got to play on my travel team, which, by the way, costs $800. Like the parents get trapped into this. And it eats up the kids' time. And it, you know, it's nice maybe to drive to Delaware for with your daughter for a weekend field hockey tournament, but to do it every other weekend, 9 months out of the year, it destroys the family culture, and it causes burnout. The kids don't come to love the sport. I remember meeting kids who were like, "Oh yeah, I played varsity. I got to play in college, but at the end of my freshman year, I quit. I was tired of baseball." I was just thinking, how do you get tired of baseball? And then I thought, I never played more than 5 months out of the year. I never had my own like trainer. My coaches were like my gym teacher or, you know, Anthony's dad. And that so I got the right amount of baseball that I loved it, and I played as long as I possibly could. These other guys, they got intensive training. What was a game?
Because it became a job.
Exactly.
You know, you mentioned in there the NBA commissioner Adam Silver even noted that we're seeing a rash of injuries amongst youth players, kids with wear and tear injuries that you'd only see in players as they got much older. I mean, I initially objected to this kind of parent, now the travel team trap, when I saw it encroaching on Sunday mornings. I thought this is crazy. There used to be at least an unwritten rule, like try to avoid games on Sunday. Then it was like, well, certainly not in Sunday mornings now. They don't even care. Sunday mornings. Yep. See ya. Like, what? Hello? Are we not going to go to church at all? Like, but now it's just, it's all encompassing. It's all 12, as you say, all 12 months of the year. And these kids are getting injuries. Kids that are having to Tommy John surgery for pitchers, you know, for their elbows or whatever. That's the kind of stuff that would kind of, they would do. It's named after a player. And this kind of stuff that you would do, you know, to give an extension on a pitcher's career. You know, they had the surgery like in their 30s or something like that.
No, it's, and one of the things it does, there was this music teacher I used to be neighbors with, and she was getting interviewed about, you know, being a great inner city school teacher. She was one of those people. I say in Family Unfriendly, she's the sort of teacher that they make movies about, right? And somebody asked her in one of these interviews, is your dream to see one of your students on stage at the Kennedy Center, the big performing arts center in DC? She couldn't stop herself. She laughed out loud. She was like, no, let me tell you about my dream student. His name is Victor. He played piano I think he still plays piano. He's now a park ranger in Utah. He's gotten into ballroom dancing. And every time he gets into something new, he writes me a long email about how much he loves it, whether it's geology of, you know, Utah or ballroom dancing or trying to be a singer or whatever. She said, he's such an expansive person. And that word, expansive, I thought, yes, that's what we want for our children, is to be expansive. So even in baseball, I noticed when I had the temptation of thinking, my oldest son, we both have boys named Charlie. My oldest son is a Charlie. He was really slow when he was younger. I was like, he's slow, but he's got a good arm. At the school where he's going to go, there's a short right field. Maybe if we put him out there. And I started explaining this to one of the teachers, and they started laughing. They're like, Tim, you're overthinking this. You have no idea. He might become a lacrosse player, which to me is like saying maybe he'll be a Yankees fan or he'll leave the church or something like that. Last year, Charlie played all 9 positions. And some other dad was talking about, well, I just want my son to get more reps at third base because I really think that's where his chance is. And I was like, this sort of thing I was saying 5 years ago. No, let him play every position. Will this get in the way of him being the best at a single position? Yes. But that's not the point of childhood. It's to expand. It should be expansive, not intensive.
Your kid's not going to be Tiger Woods. Your kid's not going to be Serena Williams. Get over yourself. I always say, I tell this to other parents, oh my gosh, if this kid doesn't get 100% on this science test, he won't go to Princeton. Oh no.
Yeah.
Do we have unrealistic expectations for a kid sometimes?
It's not just that. We have, so chapter 1 of Family and Friendly is titled, Have Lower Ambitions for Your Kids, which is tongue in cheek, right? Because you and I have the same ambitions for our kids, which is infinitely high, which is that they become saints. Our job is to help lay down the path that gets our kids into heaven. So we don't actually have low ambitions. We have, and that right there gets at the problem. What Charlie was told the one time I let him try out for, and this will come back around to the ambition. One time I let him try out for travel ball is because I thought he'd get cut. And so I did it just to make him happy. So then he makes a team. Winter workouts start January 3rd. Oh gosh. Okay. So he's in the gym and winter workouts, which should not exist for 12-year-old boys. Coach says, baseball isn't fun. Winning baseball is fun.
Oh, and, wow. Okay. All right.
So I turn that on its head. I say, successful kids aren't good. Kids are good, right? Like, that's the idea. So that bad anthropology is behind the high ambition parenting. If you think your child's worth is dependent on their achievement and their worldly success, you're much more likely to engage in this overly ambitious parenting. So this is where I think having a supernatural outlook, seeing children as a gift from God, made in the image of God, having friends who have children with severe disabilities, from Down syndrome down to a disability that's going to cause them to live, not even make their second birthday. The lessons we learn from that really drives home, okay, I know that nephew has infinite value, even though he never walked. I think my son can have infinite value, even if he never hits a ball over the fence.
Even if he missed that grounder. Oh, no.
Yes.
I think it's just kind of funny about, like, I mean, I mentioned the sports or whatever. I think the irony here is, you know, we're Gen X. Millennials were the safest, most protected generation. But they're the ones who seem to be most terrified of having kids, and it's borne out on the data in terms of, you know, the fertility. Why is that? That you would think, hey, you had such a safe childhood. This is great. You know, this is how it's supposed to be done, I guess, right?
Yeah, no. First of all, they might not have had as expansive childhoods as you and I did. I mean, I used to wander. I describe stories of wandering through the woods in the Bronx when I was a kid. Like, we lived in a nice suburb. But like, there were certain exits and you could end up in this crazy world where there's like horse trails in the Bronx. And so if you don't have that experience, again, the pediatricians say, well, you're going to have more anxiety. But I also think, again, they think they have to give their kids the best of everything. I actually ran a focus group to prepare for this book. And all of the men there, so these were people who didn't yet have kids. Some were married, some were unmarried. What many of them said was, I want to be a dad, but I don't want to just like jump into it. I want to be totally ready for it. I want to not be able to, they weren't talking
about
all
in.
Yeah, they weren't talking about having a massive mansion or anything, but send their kids to the best school, give them the best vacations, do all of that. I was like, if you get your money, yes, spend it on family stuff, right? But don't think that you're being a bad parent if your kid's only playing rec ball instead of travel ball, if your kid doesn't get vacations every summer, etc. And so that ambition is there in the millennials, which is reflecting a good ambition, but it's disordered in sort of very subtle ways. And I think that helps explain the baby bust.
Well, you mentioned this actually as part of going to the zoo thing. I mean, part of it that I think parents get caught into this trap thinking, because they look at you and me and people have six kids or whatever, and they're like, well, I couldn't possibly do that. And it's because they're carrying into it all of these unrealistic expectations. When you start having that fourth kid, that fifth kid, that sixth kid, you start to realize, wait a minute, there are trade-offs here. Maybe I don't have to pamper my kids. Maybe I don't have to give them every opportunity under the sun. And so you start realizing, is this really necessary? Everyone kind of culturally does this, but do I really need to make sure that all of my kids have that? And that can be kind of liberating.
It can be liberating. But I think what it requires for conscientious parents, because most parents are, they're neglectful parents, and this book is not, I say early on, it's not really about that subset of the population. It's more directed at middle-class, upper-middle-class parents who might worry too much about Princeton, right? Conscientious parents are really going to want to make, to care about how their kid turns out. But the phrase, how their kid turns out, is an ambiguous, open-ended phrase. And I think what a reflective Catholic or, you know, or Protestant or Jewish or Muslim, what a reflective religious dad and mom will think about is the character of this person, is their eternal soul and not their worldly achievements. There's this one video I remember of, it's a YouTube video, one of those inspirational things, and high school game, and this kid hits his game-winning three-pointer to win the conference championship. And they show it, and the coach gives him the game ball. And after like a second of like hugging the ball, he immediately sprints over to the stands to where their number one fan was, a classmate who had cerebral palsy, and hands it to that kid. And I just remember thinking, that would be success. Not that my kid hits a three-pointer, but that he does it. That's his instinct. That was the first thought he had. God, like I'm getting choked up thinking about it. This is my
goal. That'd be
goal
amazing if it was one of our kids. We'd brag about that forever. We'd brag about that more than the shot.
Yeah. And that's our ambition for our kids. So again, it's not actually lower. But if you secularize and add the modern individualism that dominates today and the materialism that comes into the vacuum created in a secular worldview, then you're going to think Princeton, D1, wealthy, that those are the only value. So I don't blame parents for having...
If there's no afterlife, everything's got to be focused on what you can possibly achieve before you hit the grave.
Yep.
And that's so the problem, right?
Having ambitions for your kids is natural, but a totally secularized world is going to have them all be worldly ambitions, and that's necessarily going to cause the anxiety. Isn't it ironic, right? The guilt was supposed to be what's inflicted by the, you know, the preachers and the Catholic Church, and now we have this sort of secular elite guilt that's making people think, if I fail at raising my kid right, or, and this is where I go in the final chapter, ultimately believing, well, I don't actually think I'm good, so why would I want more of me?
Well, and part of it is that we start believing these distortions, like these Facebook moms who, you know, have this curated view of the perfect, as you say, barn house, you know, rustic farmhouse. And, you know, they have a team of people, you know, getting her hair and makeup and all that stuff. And just another day, click, as if that's any way like anything close to reality. It's like we sort of accept, like the Kardashian view is obviously a distorted reality show, but why do so many moms think that this curated mom thing is not obviously also fake? It's not, it's manufactured.
Yeah, no, but the genius momfluencers do what I call the affect of ease, meaning they try to make it not look like the Kardashians. They try to make it look like an everyday. And I think, and when I spend—
Effortless, right. It's all effortless.
So the kids are on the front porch in their socks, and the boys are sort of elbowing each other in the picture. And the house, it's always a farmhouse, which I don't understand. But part of it is because that looks rustic. Like the exposed beams in the ceiling makes it look like, oh, we didn't even have time to put, you know, to put in the ceiling board.
It's not cookie cutter suburban hell.
Yes. It costs $1 million and the house, and they have full-time help and all of this. And that, again, sets these unrealistic expectations. But actually, there was this, at first, what was really depressing, I found this grad student who was getting a PhD in this, in mom influencers, which I call momfluencers. But then I started to read her work. And the first thing she pointed out, and she's not politically anything like me, but she said, there are no neighbors in the momosphere. And this is an interesting, I think this is a very important lesson for conservatives who really, we value the nuclear family incredibly. But as you and I were referring to earlier, these moms are getting by without ever, you know, maybe mother-in-law, but certainly not next door neighbor, certainly not sister-in-law, certainly not a babysitter, certainly not the youth sports coach. They don't fit into the Instagram feed. They might not even have the same color eyes. And so they'll clash with the photo. But that is the most pernicious illusion, that parents can raise kids without the support of a community. And when you set that up, it makes raising kids seem so much more expensive than it has to be. There was this one tweet I remember. There was a journalist who was about 30, just gotten married, he's about to have his first kid. And the tweet had sort of that two-part setup that people often do on Twitter. Step one is looks up the cost, researches the cost of a night nurse. Step two, researches how to make a socialist revolution. And so,
right.
The only sources he could imagine for help in raising his child were the market and the state. So that lack of imagination of the middle is exactly what makes parenting seem so unattainable.
That's right. That's why conservatives in general used to have this understanding of these intermediary institutions, whether it's church, there's different, organizations that are outside of, you know, like I'm a member of the Knights of Columbus, you know, there's other organizations that, in addition, that one happens to be religious, but there's other ones that are not, they're secular in nature, that you can use as like a social, as a network, a true social network, where you can actually rely on friends, you know, and say, hey, I have a problem with, I got a tree that came down my yard. Oh, I can help you with that. And, you know, so then you don't feel like you have to, it's not you versus the world. You don't have to take on all these burdens yourself, because it can be overwhelming. Like, I'm an expert on several things, but I also know I'm clueless on others. And it's liberating to know that. Like, if you have friends and we all are pitching together, this is the one thing actually is kind of funny. You mentioned this several times in the book, kind of tongue in cheek, but Hillary Clinton, I mean, she's like, she is the perfect proof of a stopped clock is right twice a day. You do say her point of it takes a village is actually, it's actually true. What do you mean by that?
Absolutely. So it does take a village to raise a child. Now, I don't know what she meant by it. She might have had some bizarre Leninist idea behind it, but parent.
Government daycare and all that kind of stuff, obviously, but the whole point is what she would say, a parent can't do it on herself.
And that's a liberal comeback that I first heard, where some conservatives have every child deserves and needs a mother and a father. And one liberal comeback is, well, four hands is not enough. And I thought, well, that part's true. Every parent who's raised a couple kids knows that they need just the youth coach, the other dad. Like, I try to convince my son to play, when he's learning to play guitar, to play more sing-along songs. And he's like, that's just because you can't sing, Dad. Anything that's difficult, you don't like. like this one, you know, crooning song can be a sing-along song. I'm like, no, you have to be able. Some other dad who plays a guitar, plays with them, is like, you know what, Charlie, you got to learn more sing-along songs, like Me and Bobby McGee, The Gambler. Charlie takes that advice from the other dad, who hasn't spent all week telling him to, you know, clean up his room, yada, yada, in a way that he does. You need, even down to that sort of little kind of thing, you need that. You need other dads who have slightly older kids to be like, what should I think about this? Or what do you think about letting your kids date? Like, you need that network in a million different ways. But I want to get back to something you said a little earlier, which is there are some things that you're not going to be good at. And you're going to rely on your friends. And that gets back to the phrase I used earlier, role-playing. Within a family, there's always going to be a division of labor. Anytime you divide labor, what do? You create vulnerability. That is, if you depend on somebody else for something, you now, as an individual, have sacrificed some of your autonomy. This is entirely what marriage is, right? Like, my goal would be, and now that I have older kids, my goal would be that my wife forgets how to pump gas. I have certainly not learned how to cook very well at all, except for scramble. If it's breakfast or on the grill, I can do it. Or corned beef and cabbage once
a year.
Same
here, brother.
Yeah. And my wife doesn't make her own coffee most mornings. And so that sort of division of labor. Also, my wife's income is very low because she mostly does the family stuff. So that creates a vulnerability, which we know vulnerability is necessary for a real loving relationship. But the spirit of the age, the modern individualism, says that vulnerability is weakness, that autonomy is a one unsacrificable good. So immersing yourself in a community has exactly that. You become a role player. And immersing yourself in a family has that times 1,000. And again, that's another way I think our culture is family unfriendly, is that the values of the day are mostly autonomy. And that's entirely averse to marriage and parenthood.
And it's not all sides. It's not even a political thing, but you hear it most, you know, when the latest actress wins, you know, and she says, it's because I believe in my dreams. And, you know, never give up on your dreams. Like, okay, honey, you also have like smashingly good looks. Okay. So that, you know, there's genetics and dumb luck. It's not really transferable to the rest of the things, but what you're saying is interdependency is actually can be a strength in a sense, because you realize what you're not good at and you end up relying on other people. And I think the bonds get stronger. You know, I mean, like, for example, just being able to have raised my family near my wife's family was a huge blessing. There was, you know, my wife was working at the hospital on the night shift, and I got, you know, I'm here at home with the, you know, with the six kids or whatever. And then my, at the time, I think it was five, and my son was the one that had a difficulty with his heart, and he had trouble breathing. And I knew this is a dangerous situation. I literally get him in the car and I start driving to the hospital, and I call her up on the phone, like, I'm heading your way to the hospital with Johnny. Call dad and tell him to come, you know, it's my father-in-law, and tell him to come to the house, watch the five kids. Yeah. I mean, it's liberating in a sense, because it's like, otherwise, what do I do? Like, I'm going to wake every kid up. It's wrong. I don't have time. I got to get him to the hospital.
So many parents today have that isolation. And so again, they can't have more than one or two. The kids don't think, it's one reason that parenting and marriage can feel like a prison to some people, is because so every stay-at-home mom I know talks about the isolation, no matter what sort of subculture you're in, except maybe the Amish, who I do interview in the book. But every stay-at-home mom talks about the loneliness. You're not alone, because there's some screaming person who wants you, or the toddler who won't even let you go to the bathroom. There's something inherently isolating about it. And so the one reason that it takes a village to raise a child is that moms who are home with the kid need neighbors. They need people who are rational humans to talk to. And I say it's really up to
de-stress, to decompress.
Local institutions to set these up, in addition to just having friends do it. I always point to the Lutheran church in my own neighborhood that had mom's Bible study. It was actually called Mom's Coffee Break. So they do some Bible study, but the whole purpose is you show up and there's a, you know, babysitters who will look after your kids. There's a children's Bible study, and you just talk to other adults. And even when, you know, the coffees that, you know, my wife would have with her other friends, they might not even get a lot of talking done because there are so many kids underfoot, but they got to see another adult who can like engage in rational thought in a way that a child doesn't. And so relieving that loneliness of parenting a young child is that's one of the things that's missing in our culture.
Well, you know, you talk a lot of things about in this book. Obviously, you said the main reason you wanted to write it was, you know, that we're facing this demographic bust. Our society is just not having enough children. Now, you and I have countered that, obviously, in our own lives. But overall, people are just having fewer and fewer kids. And if you look at it, you know, there's obviously contributing factors that are, you know, that I would just say the increasing secularism of our age, widespread pornography is another major culprit. But isn't it the case that as countries get wealthier, they just have fewer kids?
Mostly yes, which is important because that undermines the idea that, oh, nobody's having kids because we can't afford it. Wealthier countries have fewer kids. Wealthier Americans up until about 250,000. So the very wealthy Americans have more kids, but in general, wealthy Americans, the top 10% have fewer kids than the next, et cetera. The current
Even though they obviously can afford them better,
even though they can afford them better. There's a poll I want to do, or like an experiment. Ask people who don't have kids or have one kid why. And after they say affordability, like 20 minutes later in the poll, say, what would you do if you won the lottery? And see if their answer is have more kids. Because I wonder. I don't think it will be. But
probably not.
The exception, the wealthy country with the highest birth rate is Israel, which is also in some ways maybe the most educated country. So that's why the middle chapter Family Unfriendly is built around Israel and a couple of these other places where Israel's averaging 3 kids while Europe is 1.5 and the US is 1.6. So what is it? That's why it's culture. That's why culture is a word in the subtitle. Economics is part of it. Better, cheaper houses would lead to more babies, I think. But culture is ultimately the story here. And in Israel, the culture starts with the religion, but it trickles down. One of the lines somebody used with me said, in Israel, the bus drivers have a real affection for little kids. Imagine that. You tell your 8-year-old, okay, that's where the bus stop is. They go there. And you know that probably the other bus patrons, but the driver is going to look out for them. Say, come on, get on the bus, Ezra. Where are you going? Okay, that's that stop. And then we'll point out to them like, hey, look at that building. Like that's a culture that is family friendly, that is child friendly. And we could talk about the root causes of it, but it undermines the argument that, well, if you're wealthy and educated, you won't have kids. They still have 3 kids. And it's not just the religious people. Secular Jews there have 2.0. That would be, you know, more fertile. That would be almost as fertile as Catholics in the United States.
It is an amazing thing to see. Again, it just gets to culture being the primary motivator for the decision of whether they're having kids. That's why, like, we have discussions in politics. Well, you know, we favor, obviously, expanding the child tax credit, doing whatever it can to make it more affordable for people to raise kids. But that can work on the margins. I mean, it does make a bit of a difference. But ultimately, you're saying culture just weighs larger.
Yes. A culture includes, again, there's some of it that's government policy. I think sidewalks. If your culture is sidewalks and kids running around is more important than cars or some trees you're going to chop down, you're going to have more sidewalks. If everything that's being built is being built with how is this going to enable kids to roam free, parents to have fun with their kids or let their kids have fun on their own. But then the expectations that people will have kids and bring them there. And sort of the decision that we're going to accommodate, which means not treat everybody equal, we're going to accommodate parents and families. That's a decision that's part of the culture. And the cultural assumption that underlies our family unfriendly culture here is that, and I quote Stephanie Murray, who's a great parenting writer, an American. She lives in England. She writes for The Atlantic, other places. And she says something along the lines of, once having children became a deliberate choice that was mulled over and considered just as much as what college or what career or whether you're going to get a car or buy a house, then it became a personal issue. You chose to have kids. That's your problem. Don't ask us to help you out with it. Again, I'm not asking for massive subsidies. I'm just asking for the society as a whole to say, we will help you. We will help raise up the next generation. We will consider this part of the responsibility of culture rather than just being neutral, like you bought a boat and it's you have to pay the cost of it. And so that's the main way in which we have a family unfriendly culture, is it became a sort of a deliberate choice rather than a natural thing. And then psychologically,
your unique lifestyle choice, right?
Yes. That word intentional, like it's used a lot, intentional living. Once children became part of that, it became, well, congrats, I guess, have as many as you like, but don't bother us with it. Don't let them cry if they're on the airplane at 9 months and the plane is descending. Don't bring them into our restaurants. Don't expect us to narrow our lanes, chop down our trees, or do anything else to accommodate your family that you chose as your own lifestyle.
See, we're old enough. We still remember when restaurants, you could actually smoke cigarettes in restaurants. And we had a section that was smoking and a section that was non-smoking. And then people are like, we should do this for other restaurants. Like, no kids over here and kids over there. And it's like, kids are not cigarettes. Okay, people. Yeah, they can be sometimes. Other people's kids can sometimes be loud and annoying a little bit, but get over yourself. You're not going to get lung cancer secondhand because of kids. I think we got to stop treating them as only, you know, pests and stuff like that, and have a little bit more levity to it.
Yeah. And the fact is that for most people, and I cite some of the psychological studies in the book, for most people, having children around actually makes them more generous. And as for society, having children around makes us more hopeful and happier. And so this is where the death spiral comes in. In South Korea, fewer children means a less happy society means fewer children. And it spirals down. And so that's why you worry anytime anyone's below...
Despair spiral, yeah.
Below replacement, you have to worry whether it's going to keep going down.
Well, I think... the first step we can take here in the United States to try to turn this around is to get Catholics to embrace a culture that is family friendly. And I would recommend all Catholics listening to get themselves a copy of Tim's book, Family Unfriendly, which is due out on March 19. I'm guessing you picked the Solemnity of St. Joseph on purpose.
That was entirely providence. I lobbied. I said, move it as early in March as possible. And I said, how does March 19th sound? That sounds great to me.
Well, St. Joseph, a great patron for dads like you and me, we ask for his intercession in our lives and also for anyone listening. And thank you so much for joining us here on the Loopcast. Tim, thanks so much for being with us.
It was my pleasure, Josh. Thanks.